Cheer the worshipers! Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We're going to have an interesting program today because I'm going to ask you to think about the question I'm about to raise. And then after I play an extended audio clip, I'd like for you to give your insights, your perspective. If you personally have found this to be true and if you've made changes in your life because of that, it's going to be about what I consider the most important problem we face today. In fact, it is the problem, and everything else comes after that as a symptom. I'll get to that in a little bit. And then on tonight's Progressive Commentary Hour, I just want to let you know I have a whole hour set aside going into great detail about why Gaddafi had to be killed, brutally killed. What message it sent to all the African leaders who wanted their own independence away from the dollar as the reserve currency and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and all of the people going into Africa to destroy its natural resources by exploiting them. And the one person who had a chance to turn it all around and was doing exactly that was Gaddafi. But unfortunately, we as a society, including unfortunately and really regrettably, many people on the left or the so-called liberal community supported that. Supported going in regime change. They supported it with Gaddafi in Libya. They supported it in Syria. I was wondering, will the left or the liberal community challenge those who are warmongers? Now, it's fine to have someone on your show to talk about women's rights or Black Lives Matter. That's good. But then to allow those same people of color to be exploited by being killed because you believe that regime change is a good thing in a foreign country, that is very arrogant. So shame on the left for that, because they didn't stand up against it, not in Congress, not in the media. So I'm going to dedicate an hour to why they got rid of him, what Libya was like, and all those decades before, all the freedoms they had. And I'm not making any decision on Gaddafi. What you believe about Gaddafi, you can believe about Gaddafi. I'm talking about the Libyan people, their government, their rights, their freedoms. It was the Paris of Africa. Of all the countries in Africa, 54 countries, the most prosperous, highest educated, higher than the United States, higher than Great Britain, higher than Germany. How about that? But you didn't know that. No, that's propaganda. That's conditioning. That's what happens when outside sources control our behavior, more often than not through fear. So it's a whole hour tonight at 7 o'clock. You won't want to miss it because you're not going to hear this information anywhere else in any media. You won't read about it. It's a phenomenal document. It's taken a long time to put this together. That's at 7 o'clock. Go to prn.fm. Or you can go in and listen over the telephone. Let me just give you that number real quick. That number to listen live, 424-203-8046, 424-203-8046. Or if you want to download the show afterwards, 701-719-9976. But we always begin our program with the latest on health and healing, something that everyone in the world can benefit from. Now, we want to drink with glass because it's more environmentally beneficial. It helps the environment, where plastic lasts forever. In fact, if you throw away a plastic cup today, it will outlive you. Even if you're 1 year old, it'll still be there when you're dead. But that doesn't mean that drinking glasses or drinking from glasses don't have some potential harm. That harm is lead and cadmium. Now, according to the University of Plymouth, which is in the United Kingdom, In enameled drinking glasses and popular merchandise can contain toxic chemicals. I'm not talking about a regular glass. I'm talking when they try to bring it up market, make it more interesting. And they did 197 tests and on 72 new and secondhand drinking glass products, tumblers, beer and wine glasses, and jars. They found lead present in 139 cases and cadmium 134, both on the surface of the glasses and in some instances on the rims, with concentrations of lead sometimes more than 1,000 times higher than the limit level, safe limit level. Now, tests showed that flakes of paint often came away from the glass under when simulated sustained use, indicating the substances could be ingested over a prolonged period of time. So, don't buy anything in the way of glasses if there's paint on them, or just buy regular glass. That's simple enough. We have advocated for, we meaning those of us in the health movement, for decades, for the relationship between an unhealthy diet and cancer. There was once a director of the National Cancer Institute, a very nice gentleman. I went down to Washington to interview with him, and at the time, we were doing an article on the politics of cancer, Robert Houston and myself. And Robert, who I haven't seen in 30 years, just met with him. He came on the air a couple months ago. A little background. I was asked by Pat McGrady Jr., a very highly respected journalist. He had been the Moscow bureau chief for Newsweek. And he said that, would I be willing to do an article on the politics of cancer? No one had done one, not in any national magazine or newspaper. And I said, why? What's wrong? He said, well, it's nothing but politics. There's a certain group of people getting all the money. The president's National Cancer Advisory Board has gross conflict of interest because the people who are appointed to sit on the president's board are also running institutions and give themselves the majority of the money. They're taking it from one hand. Well, I'm on the national board. Let's give it over to this university where I'm also the head of a department. And that was part of it. The other part was that I had been doing some preliminary interviews to see if some doctors who were treating cancer using natural therapies were having success, but it was a long process. I had to wait years. And so I said, all right, and he introduced me then to his father. His father had run the public relations for the American Cancer Society, Pat McGrady Sr. He gave us all the material. So after reading everything and doing research and independent confirmation, I wrote an article along with Bob on the politics of cancer. It would later end up on 60 Minutes, so later than that on 2020, then Gabe Pressman. Whole lot of people used material from that original series. I did, I think, around 48 articles on American medical genocide. And a lot of the initial articles were on cancer. So I went to Washington. I wanted to meet with the director of the National Cancer Institute. And he was open and cordial. And he showed me, because there was Dr. Dean Burke, one of the founders of National Cancer Institute, that all these research papers they had done in the 1950s and 60s on nutrition and cancer. It was there. It was just not being popularized because that would have competed with chemotherapy and radiation. And one of his final statements in our conversation was that we can do the research and we can prove there's an association with a bad diet causing cancer and a great diet helping to prevent it and even reverse it, but it's not going to make it through the media. There's just too many people watching out for Big Pharma. He was correct. This is the latest. This is from the Los Angeles Times. And this was just, this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. They did a report on cancer and body fat. 13 different cancers can now be linked to being overweight or obese. I mentioned that earlier in the week. But also, they're now taking a look at how close it is that you could develop cancer. And there's a big group of scientific papers out there now showing that, yeah, they can pinpoint specific foods that cause cancer. It's in large part because nutrition studies aren't well suited to cracking the problem, so they give the they give it almost no attention. They say, well, there's no real evidence that cancer. The people saying that haven't read their own studies, because yes, there are studies, lots of studies. For example, the more meat you have, the more likely you are to have breast cancer, prostate cancer, and ovarian cancer, and colorectal cancer. The more sugar you have and meat, more cancer. The less fiber you had, more colorectal cancer. So, and we're eating nothing but a processed diet if you're the average American today. We also can show the same kind of food imbalances our insulin levels, causing insulin resistance, and that can promote tumors directly and indirectly, which most people are not aware of. If you're overweight, you have more estrogen, and estrogen dominance can cause cancer. So men and women who are overweight, just that alone, just being overweight, increase your risk of cancer. Now, if you're under stress, that increases insulin also, estrogen also. So high-protein diets, being overweight, and being stressed, just one major cause of cancer. So from now on, understand that what the medical mainstream community is doing, what the mainstream scientific community is doing, is what they're told to do. So just stop listening when it comes to health, because unfortunately, they've had at least 60 years to get it right, and they're still getting it wrong. If you've taken melatonin, good for you. 1 milligram, even 2 milligrams. But the University of South Carolina and the Moscow Medical Institute have found that it can actually be an anti-aging nutrient. Here's how it works. We have what are called mitochondria. Those are the little energy factories in the body. That's what allows us to have a lot of get up and go. Well, the mitochondria decline starts at around age 30. And as they decline, we become far more susceptible to neurodegeneration, diabetes, and obesity. In a discovery published just this year, scientists found that the natural hormone melatonin works in a unique way to combat mitochondrial dysfunction. And a contributor to mitochondrial dysfunction is the opening of a hole in the mitochondrial inner membrane that decreases their ability to produce energy. Preventing or closing this hole is a key to preserving youthful mitochondria function, meaning more energy, more strength. So up until recently, there was no drug that could do that. But this study showed that melatonin does exactly that. It helps maintain normal levels of an enzyme whose job it is to plug that hole. And by preserving mitochondria function, melatonin, mela, M-E-L-A, tonin, T-O-N-I-N, exerts a highly targeted and specific action on a fundamental cause of aging. Melatonin, by the way, has long been hailed for its benefits on cellular function and disease prevention, as well as its impressive impact on longevity in animal models. In a study published this year, scientists uncovered a new way that melatonin promotes longevity. And now I'm just suggesting to you that if you want to burn more fuel inside the cell so you have more energy for your brain to think and act and your body to move, then you want to understand that energy release occurs in the form of molecules, ATP, adenosine triphosphate, and ATP drives every cellular function that requires energy. That's all of life. So low levels of ATP result in diminished energy and decreased cellular function, and you can't detoxify the body, so debris builds up. You can't repair damaged tissue, so DNA damage accelerates. And even every tissue and organ and system in your body is impacted. And the number of mitochondria in our cells and their efficient function degrades over time. And that's why PPQ and NAD and the different nutrients I've suggested that you consider taking, the science is there to show you that it really does make a difference. But getting your mitochondria working, that's also. And so the mitochondria is important, so take your melatonin. I would suggest, and by the way, there's an enzyme called CNPASE, and that protects the mitochondria. So just something new. And 1 milligram a night of melatonin 2 hours before you go to bed is good. Also from the University of Michigan, increased omega-3 intake is associated with improved mood and better sleep. And if you're a lupus patient, it's really good for you. In fact, the American College of Rheumatology and the Association of Rheumatology Health Professionals at an annual meeting recently showed findings of how you can get better sleep quality and mood improvement when you're increasing your omega-3 fatty acids. Anyone with autoimmune disease should be taking their omega-3. I suggest 1,000 milligrams in the morning, the 1,500 and the same in the evening. You also, by the way, that's just helping you get better sleep, better mood, but it also helps protect your heart. It's good for your brain. So just something new. And also from Oxford University in the Great Britain, to help your memory and help slow down any dementia, the B complex. That's what they're showing. According to the latest study, we have nearly 6 million Americans with Alzheimer's who've been diagnosed. Now, a lot of them have not because they're in the early stages. They might have mild cognitive impairment, meaning intermittent memory loss, generally short-term memory loss. They can tell you details of a conversation from 20 years ago, but they can't tell you what they ate this morning. And this form of dementia has Western medicine baffled. They're just looking for drugs. They're not looking for lifestyle because there's no money. There's no awards. There's no Nobel Prize in saying, oh, get a raw food diet that has the right pH and alkalize your blood and get the right nutrition going to your brain to repair the neurons. And no, they're not going to do that. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't. And one of the things you could do is pay attention to the amino acid called HOMO, H-O-M-O, cysteine, C-Y-S-T-E-I-N-E. Why? Because it's a very important biological marker. Everyone I work with who has dementia, Alzheimer's, or memory loss, multiple sclerosis, or Parkinson's, I have NALS, I have them check into a chemistry biomarker, and almost always, homocysteine is elevated, 17, 18, 20, very dangerous. It's a predictor of Alzheimer's disease, meaning that elevated levels of homocysteine are linked directly with an increased risk of developing Alzheimer's or dementia. But homocysteine may play a more destructive role. Many researchers feel that this pro-inflammatory substance is also a potential cause of brain damage associated with Alzheimer's, and giving credence to the theories, the fact that raised homocysteine levels are frequently found in patients with mild cognitive impairment. So what do you do? It's simple. B6, 50 milligrams. DMG, 100 milligrams. TMG, 200 milligrams. Folic acid, 1 milligram. B12, 1 milligram. And B1 and 2, 50 milligrams, and you just brought down your homocysteine. How simple and easy is that to protect your brain? And if you have it, if you know someone, definitely give them that simple formula. So B-complex every day will make a big difference. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Music, what good is melody if it ain't possessing something sweet? It ain't the music, it ain't the melody. There's something else that makes that tune complete.
There's many ways of approaching a problem. There are many truths. There's not just one truth. There's not just one diet. So when it comes to the environment, when it comes to our quality of life, our longevity, our ability to sustain life, we know that we have choices. We have freedoms. Yes, we are also having those freedoms breached and encroached upon, And that's why we do the specials, commentaries, and have people on like Chris Hedges and others that bring to our attention that while you were distracted, another right was taken away. Another major corporation had a get-out-of-jail-free card. They could commit crimes against humanity, and nobody's going to hold them accountable. You jaywalk, and you end up with a ticket. You're poor, you can go to poverty prisons. If you're rich, no. So we have thousands of these little issues and some major issues, our banking issues, the fact that we're not saving, the fact that we're not paid a living wage, the fact that we're overworked. But think of it, just for a moment. What's behind all this? Consumption. We're over-consuming. We're obese because we overconsume calories. We're sick because we consume way too much of the wrong foods that are harmful, meat, sugar, dairy. We're living in dangerous places that we shouldn't be in. And yet when you ask people, why don't you get out of harm's way? It's not that there was one tidal wave, one tsunami, one earthquake, one. It's going to keep happening. It's going to get worse. People don't like to move away from their stuff. And it seems that we have an inordinate preoccupation in America with having more stuff. So shouldn't we begin the whole process of looking how we could change the war on poverty and all these other wars that we have by first stop using the concept of war? Instead, rethink that what would happen if we stopped consuming everything, traveling everywhere, causing global warming no matter what we do? Shouldn't we pay attention to it? But to do that, we would have to then say, are we one of those excess consumers? Are we contributing by our inability to control our desire for things, even if we don't need them? With that said, we're going to play a clip now on the fact that we're living non-sustainable lives. And then I'm going to open it up for your comments at the end for how you see us being able to make the changes, and have you made the changes yourself, and what has been the impact? Please listen.
Past 3 years, I've been trying multiple ways of trying to get people to understand the simple fact, yes, there are very big, powerful people that own and control this world, but they are nothing without our active or passive participation in their game. But this is a reoccurring process that has happened over and over again throughout history, and that while the names and faces and races have changed over the years, there is one common theme that has happened throughout all of history, and it is that cunning men consolidate power by spreading lies down to the masses to get them to willingly or unwillingly sacrifice their power up to the men that own and control that paradigm. What once started as the raping and pillaging of men like Genghis Khan soon turned into religious oligarchs getting the masses to sacrifice up to a god, which, oh by the way, empowered those that had the special knowledge at the top. Then some cunning men got the idea that they were divine rulers, and that the masses needed to support them either through serfdom or taxation. And when there was not enough wealth to support these greedy men, they set about colonizing other nations to steal from them. And still other cunning men got the bright idea to throw out the religious and royal oligarchs and fool the masses into worshipping the state, which then enriched the cunning men that were at the top of that scheme. And then we got to World War II, where the United States defeated all those and was the sole inheritor of the world. The United States came out of World War II relatively unscathed, while the rest of the world's productive capacity was decimated. But the cunning men that were at the top of this system started to panic, because now the rest of the world was destroyed, and without further war, there was no need for such manufacturing. The domestic population of the United States had learned sacrifice in living well below their means, and with the massive debts that the war produced, without a new expansion into a new area, the whole scheme would fall apart once again. Then came along a very cunning man named Edward Bernays, that was Sigmund Freud's nephew. He introduced a new twist to the game called consumerism, where he would get people to buy things that they did not need with money that they did not have. This was a perfect complement to our debt-based monetary system.
There is a story of a New England farmer with a small pond in his pasture. Each summer, a group of wild ducks would frequent that pond. Try as he would, the farmer could never catch one. No matter how early in the morning he approached, no matter how carefully he constructed a blind, or what kind of duck call he tried, somehow those crafty birds sensed the danger and managed to be out of range. Of course, when fall arrived, the ducks headed south, and the farmer's craving for a duck dinner only intensified. Then he got an idea. In the spring, he started scattering corn along the edge of the pond. The ducks liked corn, and since it was always there, they soon gave up on dipping and foraging for food on their own. After a while, they became used to the farmer and began to trust him. They could see he was their benefactor, and now they walked close enough to him with no sense of fear. Life was so easy they forgot how to fly. But soon it was unimportant, because now they were so fat they couldn't have gotten off the water even if they tried. Fall came and the ducks stayed. Winter came and the pond froze. The farmer built a shelter to keep them warm. The ducks were happy because they didn't have to fly. The farmer was especially happy because each week, all winter long, he had a delicious duck dinner. That is the story of America's Great Depression and our future. Wild horses used to roam the countryside free and independent. The same process man used to domesticate the horse is the same process the elite have done to enslave humanity.
And proved to be very successful for the next 60 years as the world latched on to the new religion of consumerism.
Welcome to Pat's Songs.
For the next 19 hours, we input orders, tray food, vent drinks, obstacle condiments, wipe tables, and bin garbage. All done in strict adherence to First Catechism.
What is the First Catechism?
Honor thy consumer.
The baby boom generation that came out of post-World War II era embraced debt like there was no tomorrow. While this generation initially rebelled against the establishment with their sex, drugs, and rock and roll in the 60s and 70s, by the time the 80s had rolled around, they had bought in hook, line, and sinker into the American dream of consumerism, sacrificing family for careers, embracing debt, and chasing the American dream. This generational surge was only made possible by the relative peace of the post-World War II era, massively expanding energy production that coincided with the baby boom and the debt explosion. But only now are Americans starting to realize that what they sacrificed so much for was a lie.
Your generation is definitely not headed for bingo night. In fact, you could write a book about how you're going to turn retirement upside down.
And what I do is when people come in, I greet them.
With this new religion of consumerism, no longer do people have to sacrifice for heaven. They can get instant gratification by simply buying things. No longer did it matter what kind of character or morals or empathy that one had. People now became identified by what they had and what they did to earn those things. As humanity tried to keep up with the Joneses, they slowly found themselves that they were in a rigged game. The things that they thought that they owned ended up owning them. What was expensive and fashionable one year was worthless and old the next. And yet the debts continued to mount, and the profits rolled in for the next big thing.
And while everyone you know may own the fanciest clothes
and the best cars, you will own the companies that sell them.
If you want to know what heaven really is, Murray,
try being God.
These debts and profits funded the war machine that then went out to seize the natural and human resources of the rest of the world. Once conquered, the bankers and the corporations came in to harvest the natural and human resources of the world. These profits were then funneled through Wall Street, that used their profits to manipulate the political system and media to ensure that the game is continually rigged. The sad fact is that this consumeristic world made debt slaves out of the consumers only to buy goods from slaves in other countries. And at the top of every system are the cunning men that created, perpetuated, and profited off of these paradigms. Because of these debts, our careers, and our service to this paradigm, we have empowered the worst in humanity that simply wants more power, more control, more domination.
See, I find that everybody has a number, and it's usually an exact number, so what is yours?
More.
Instead of cultivating this earth into a better place, we have sought to exploit for the quickest profit. It is said that the average American family produces 5 pounds of garbage per day. The scary fact is that it is estimated that 70 times that amount of garbage is produced in the manufacturing and transportation of that garbage. And for what?
We have a world today that has awesome technical knowledge to be able to develop a $69 million hypersonic autonomous kamikaze bombs that can strike anywhere in the world within minutes, and yet we have a society that cannot become conscious to the fact that they are slaves living depressing, malnourished, narcissistic little lives. Well, who cares if we can technically watch a 3D, 80-inch, high-definition TV instantly downloading the latest Kardashian show dressed in a Prada spacesuit while driving a Mercedes moon buggy on the moon? On your deathbed, will you be thinking about all the technical things that you were able to do, or the idealistic relationships and passions you did not pursue? I can tell you what Steve Jobs wished for. He wished he could have gotten to know his kids better. All of the technical progress we have made in war, communication, finance, government, and consumer gadgets are worthless if those lives that are building, consuming, and dying for these goods are soulless creatures who do not think for themselves. And what is the result of all this technical thinkers manipulating our world? We have rigged the world to blow with massive financial fraud that will technically end the world as we know it. And for what? Do we technically live better than we did 50 years ago? And by what measure? Happiness, obesity, education, divorce? We need the ability to ask why we do things and not how to technically do things. Maybe then we can ask why we should even build a hypersonic bomb. Does it make the world better? Who does it benefit? How would these resources be better used? And do we even have the right to take from some to destroy others? Without a greater sense of life behind our technical actions, we will continue this painful existence on Earth. You cannot change the outside world to become free or happy. You must change yourself to become free and happy.
Most of the stuff that we buy, we don't even use a week later. If you try to sell it at a garage sale, it's only worth 5 cents on a dollar. And yet we still continue to play into this game. We go to work to buy more stuff, and then we feel bad, and go to work and buy more stuff, and then we feel bad. This negative loop will end at some point, and it will most likely come when the dollar collapses. As consumerism has spread throughout the United States, it has turned the landscape of this country into one gigantic strip mall, replacing cultural identity with brands. This has led to a massive misallocation of wealth, because nearly 70% of the U.S. economy is now revolving around consumer debt.
In this moment, we're going to play you another. Let's put this in context. How much of the choice that we make each day, what we're going to eat, where we're going to eat, what we're going to do, what time we're going to spend with friends, family, ourselves, a book we're going to read, something we're going to do that challenges us intellectually, emotionally, creatively, spiritually, is set aside because we're consuming. We're purchasing, we're buying, we're using. All that is a passive existence. It doesn't help us as individuals to evolve, but it does mean that we're being controlled. I'm going to play only part of this next one before we go to your calls, but let's focus on one thing he just said. He said that all this is going to collapse. And you think, well, how that's possible? Look at all of our wealth. We have 10 million millionaires. We have 17.2 million professional class that live like millionaires because they can accumulate debt because they're lawyers and doctors and engineers and professors and architects and CPAs. So you have 100 million people living very nicely. They're buying all these toys for themselves. But it couldn't possibly end. Well, there was a housing development in St. Louis. And it was one of the first in America. When, before we even had our movement out on Long Island with Lefrak City, they were already there, and there were over 10,000 people living middle-class, comfortable lives. They had food, they had clothing, they had good schools, and then it all changed because people began to move to the suburbs, and there was no longer the money to sustain that whole housing complex. And it didn't take long before windows weren't repaired, fuel wasn't delivered in the wintertime, security wasn't at the doors, and then drug dealers came in, then gangs came in, and then it was just a completely deplorable place. And unfortunate because the people, the inhabitants, had nothing to do with it. It had to do with you didn't have the resources. So what's going to happen? Here's my own guesstimate. I believe that within the next 5 years, we'll begin to see cities go bankrupt, industries close, automation will wipe out a lot of people's jobs in factories and floor workers. You'll have so many Visa, highly educated and good people. There's nothing wrong with them. But look, they're in India, they're South Africa, or South Korea, they're China. They want a better life for themselves. They're willing to work for $40,000 or $50,000 a year, where they're going to take the place of someone making $150,000 or $200,000 a year who's been there 25 years. You're not going to get health benefits. You're not going to get paid vacation days, but they don't care. Well, when you have millions of those individuals taking millions of other Americans' jobs, there's no other job for those Americans to get unless it's by bagging groceries at a local store. So we're going to have double the unemployment that we have now, double it in the next 10 years. You're also not going to see the money available for the community, so roads won't be fixed. And then you're going to have all the wealth concentrated in several thousand what I call green zones. And a green zone is an area where you have so much wealth that they demand that their streets, their community is completely protected. That means you're going to have identity cards or identity chips. If you want to work in that environment, you have to prove that you belong in that environment. So they can monitor you. They can monitor every place you go that day. So those people go in have to be checked in. Those people that go out have to be checked out. And so that's a protected zone. People can then go out at night. They can go to dining and movies, whatever they choose to culturally. They don't have to really fear that somehow there's going to be a downside to where they're living, because they've controlled the environment. They control the government. They control the financing. They control the police. They control the judiciary. But what if you live outside of the green zone? Even in New York, do you think all of New York and all of its boroughs are going to be green zone? Absolutely not. But some areas would be. Manhattan would be. And part of Brooklyn would be. But a lot of Queens and Brooklyn and Harlem would not be. Nor Staten Island. Malibu would be. And Beverly Hills would be. And Bel Air would be. But West Los Angeles, Southeast Los Angeles would not be. So you'd have, in all the major cities, you'd have your green zones, but then you have your non-green zones. And with about 1.5 million organized criminals in the gang system, that's going to flourish. And they're going to take advantage of the people who are most susceptible, the soft targets, senior citizens living in gated communities. Gated communities is where a lot of upper middle class or wealthy people live. And because you get 1,000 or 2,000 people there and you got someone at a gate called security, that doesn't mean anything. If someone wants to come in there and put a gun to the guy's head and says, you know, we're going to go here, you sit here, you don't move, and then they go house to house and rob people. You're gonna see America de-evolve into a massive battlefield and with fear outside the green zones. And that does not include the impact that's going to be happening to our country because of environment, with greater heat and greater rain, greater hurricanes. So what you're looking at now is the best that America could possibly be, and from here it goes downhill. Now let's listen to part two, a different documentary, part two on consumerism and how it impacts us and controls our entire body politic and lives.
The typical middle to upper middle class household occupies more than 2,000 square feet of floor space, owns at least 2 cars, a couple of couches, numerous chairs, beds and tables, a washer and dryer, more than 2 televisions, a VCR, and has cable. The kitchen contains a conventional oven, a microwave, a frost-free refrigerator, a blender, a coffee maker, a tea kettle, a food processor, and so many pots, pans, dishes, cups, glasses, storage containers, kitchen utensils, and pieces of flatware that they aren't even counted. Elsewhere in this house are a personal computer and a printer, telephones, an answering machine, a calculator, a stereo or CD player, musical instruments, and many pieces of art. In addition to paintings and reproductions, there are decorative items such as vases, plates, and statuettes, photographs in frames, and knickknacks. In the bathroom are a hairdryer, a scale, perhaps an electric toothbrush or shaver, and cabinets overflowing with towels, shampoos, conditioners, face creams, and other cosmetics. The closets are stuffed with clothes and shoes of all types, dresses, blouses, suits, pants, shirts, sweaters, coats, hats, boots, sneakers, flats, pumps, walking shoes, patent leathers, and loafers. And don't forget the jewelry. In addition to watches, the diamond ring, and other high-value items, there's usually a large collection of costume jewelry. Bead necklaces, bracelets, and earrings. The family room is filled with books, videos, tapes, CDs, magazines, and more photos and knickknacks. The floors are covered with rugs or carpet, and throughout the house are scattered other pieces of furniture, accented perhaps with dried or silk flowers. Stored in the garage or basement is all the sports equipment, such as bicycles and skis, as well as luggages and totes, lawn and garden tools. In addition to all these durable products, households spend heavily on services such as childcare, movies, restaurants and bars, hotel stays, airplane trips, haircuts, massages. This is to Disney World, lawyer bills, insurance premiums, interest payments, and sometimes rental on the storage space or even more stuff for sides. If you are a typical consumer, you did not always have so much. There was probably a time in your adult life when you could fit everything you owned into your car and drive off into the sunset. Now you need professionals to transport your possessions.
If I find something that I really love, I've got to have it. If that's materialistic, yes.
Americans are, in fact, too materialistic.
Is that a joke question? Oh my God, it's disgusting. We're an extremely materialistic culture.
Now, wait a minute, just a minute. What's wrong with this type of materialism?
I think many of us in our society, our consumer society, are so distracted, so alienated, so fragmented by the whole consumption process that we are not sure if we've actually been alive.
Feeling alive in this country has come to be a counterfeit feeling, and that we think that when we buy something, we have an excitement and we think we're feeling alive.
The problem is that the moment doesn't last because it's brought on by particular circumstances. So then you have to shop again.
On one level, the Industrial Revolution transformed the very nature of work, replacing the slow, deliberate age of craftsmanship with the planned frenzy of the factory.
Machines, inventions, power, black out the past. Forget the quiet cities. Bring in the steam and steel, the iron men, the giants. Open the throttles faster and faster.
But on another level, as the sheer speed and efficiency of the new age exploded into unprecedented levels of productivity, something more fundamental was in the process of being transformed. The very way people saw themselves and their place in the world. In the process, revolutionizing not only how much stuff we were able to produce for others, but how much we would be able to acquire for ourselves.
Right before the century turned, we had the roaring 90s.
Hello, my honey. Hello, my ragtime gal.
My baby.
Send me a kiss by wire.
Which were a period like the 1920s and the 1980s and 90s, which was a period, a lot of wealth being made, a lot of wealth being concentrated at the top. So the distribution got more and more unequal.
So in American culture, the first person that really looked carefully at over-the-top consumption was this wonderful, curmudgeon, cantankerous character named Thorsten Veblen.
Thorsten Veblen wrote his classic theory of the leisure class, and that was a partly satirical but very serious look at the growing role of using products to convey social status and to create social superiority. You know, obviously took a dislike to ostentation and wealth, saw it as a, you know, a violation of the type of values that he thought the country should be expressing.
And for the first time, he really laid out the importance of consumption as a way of defining self, that you would consume, as he said, conspicuously, because you wanted somebody else to see exactly who you were. American culture does, after World War II, take a profound shift.
I wish I had a castle in the sky where we could watch the world go by with silver.
People who had always yearned to be part of the consumerist mentality were allowed in. And they were allowed in both because they had the disposable time and the disposable money. And also because the suppliers of objects, cars, refrigerators, all kinds of things that had been difficult to get to, now were streaming this stuff at ever cheaper prices into a eager community of consumers.
Hurry, 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 hurry. The world is so full of a number of things, and we don't want to miss any.
And so you had more and more people from the working class being incorporated into a middle class lifestyle, being able to own homes, move to the suburbs, and so forth. The idea of keeping up with the Joneses arises in that context. And the idea is that the Joneses live, you know, in the house next door in the subdivision, and you're watching them as they accumulate Chevy, washing machine, television. Keeping up with the Joneses means trying to keep up with a rising standard of living, looking at people you know, people you live among, so it's a neighborhood-based model. I think the other important part about that model, in contrast to today, is that it was a model of face-to-face social interaction. People wanted things not because the advertisers told them they needed to have them, but because their neighbor had it, and they saw the Chevy drive into the driveway. People saw the new clothing or the stuff for the kids or whatever it was, and they saw it and wanted it, and it was really a model of social comparison. In the 70s, you start to see things changing. A couple of big changes. One is the number of women going into the workforce, working for pay, increases, particularly among married women, married with children. They shift out of that more egalitarian neighborhood context into corporations, which are very hierarchical. And so they're exposed to people of higher economic levels, their boss, their boss's boss, and so forth. And then the other key thing is that instead of a situation in which people all up and down the economic distribution are pretty much just looking to others who are like them, more and more people start to gaze toward the top. The so-called affluent lifestyle. Now that happens for a couple of reasons. One is that those people are becoming very conspicuous in the way they're consuming. They're getting into the newspapers and the magazines. Some of the most famous examples of this start in the 1980s, Dallas and Dynasty. Soap operas, which had always overrepresented the wealthy, come into prime time and are seen by many, many more people. This is the era where you have the show, The Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, which eventually, you know, morphs into MTV's Cribs and then Home and Garden TV. And as people watch more and more media, they're no longer seeing what's happening with their neighbors because they're increasingly don't even know their neighbors. Or new kinds of houses got built where people drive right into the house when they come home and they don't have to go outside. So the decline of social interaction at the neighborhood level becomes very important. And it's a process like what Veblen was talking about in the 1890s. Really, really conspicuous consumption.
Enter the age of modern advertising. Consumption may have been conspicuous, but appeals to our consumer desires would become even more so, giving rise to a glistening new world of images and messages and brands. A world of surface appeals targeted at deep human needs by a new class of experts charged with awakening our inner urge to shop.
For those of us who have enough, we are no longer stimulated by our cravings and our scarcity to consume more. So now, in order to make us consume more, we are subjected to a lot of propaganda.
Oh my God, everything is advertising.
We're being run by our subconscious drives. And as long as we're being run by our subconscious drives, then those who are conscious of those drives can manipulate them and control them. And so then it's really just lining up the barnyard animals, and farmers find that if you play soothing music, the cows give better milk. So you get mall music everywhere.
We'll be right back.
advertising and marketing that has just become phenomenally sophisticated over the last 40 or 50 years is in very large part running the whole consumer culture.
On every billboard, radio, and television, on every newspaper and magazine.
And it's frightening because they've gotten so good at reaching in and finding what motivates, you know, the macho man or the even beautiful woman but who wants to be more beautiful or the uncomfortable teenager. Like, they know how to go straight to our fears.
Ladies and gentlemen, this commercial is going to use subliminal advertising.
In a very strange way, I think our society is being subjected to a kind of mind control.
That means you will never see or hear the name of the product.
It's very much to me like the movie The Matrix.
Sales, they've got to go up.
We have to step back out of the Matrix and learn how to make choices for ourselves.
You are powerless.
I'll show you how powerless I am.
My brain burns with it.
They've switched. It used to be, you know, if you buy this, then you'll be popular. And now it's buy this and you will be happy.
Make your holiday wishes come true.
They're very, very clever. And no, I think it's a, particularly towards kids.
I think it's enormously unfair to take some of the best trained minds in cognitive psychology, to take some of the best trained technicians working with computer animations and graphics, put those together into short segments of 30 seconds or so that tell people, well, here's who you are and here's what's important.
Let's not forget the young people.
In my last book, Born to Buy, I did a survey of kids. This is a group, the market is called tweens. They're marketed to very, very intensely. What my survey found is that involvement in consumer culture undermines kids' well-being in a variety of ways, that the kids who are less exposed, those kids are better off. They're healthier. They have a better sense of self.
Give those kids something for their busy little minds, I always say.
I used a statistical model that allows us to ask the question, is it poor parenting that leads to consumer involvement? But what's interesting today is that the good parents and the bad parents have super consumer involved kids.
We're spending 20 times as much to target kids with advertising today as we were in 1980. This is paying off.
There's more to it, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to call in now at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. And share your points of view. We have a wide variety of people in this audience, all different backgrounds, ages, educational levels. And how does this speak to you? If not you directly, do you see this? Are you in that nice space where you can look at the world for what it is without first judging it? Because the moment you judge something, it changes how you look at it. And the fact that we do pride ourselves in what we own, and that becomes an extension of our identity. My concept is simple. I believe that you are far more significant as a human being and as a sacred spirit than you are by what you own. And yet today, it's all about what we own, and then being angry by not having more and therefore not appreciating frequently what we do have. Your thoughts, please. 888-874-4888. And also let me mention that on the Progressive Commentary Hour, you are going to have such a history lesson of Africa, of North Africa, of Gaddafi, and the fact that we were conditioned to believe that he was evil. He was a Hitler. He was corrupt. He was all these bad things. Therefore, we had to protect his people because he was killing his own people. He was not killing his own people. That was a lie. And it was all set up like a false flag. and we were behind it. Now, in retrospect, we have evidence of that in other areas. So I'm going to do a whole hour on this tonight at 7 o'clock. I ask a specific question. I'm happy to take anyone who has a perspective about how much influence we have upon the planet, each other. Remember, if you're buying a cell phone, and that cell phone's major resources came from a poor country in Africa or a poor country in Asia, and do you think about, is anyone being exploited for you to be able to use this current gadget? The average person only keeps a cell phone about 18 months. And we throw away millions, completely good computers and cell phones every year because we want the newest model of something. Well, think of what that does to the environment. Think of what it does to the destruction of finite resources. So what would happen, for example, if we simply stopped long enough before we made a purchase and asked, do I need it? And if it's clothing, is this being produced by slave labor in Bangladesh or other countries? Or was this made by someone with a fair wage? Is this a green product? Can this be recycled? These are the questions we should be asking ourselves. Let's hear from Ernie in Westchester. Hi, Ernie.
Thank you, Gary, for all what you do and the information you provide. You write about the one thing which happened that I noticed that most of my relatives go by price. They don't even look at the labels on things. It's really bothersome because it's also very difficult that because when you have limited money, you are going to go towards something that is much cheaper than or that you can afford. So it's like a catch-2 where they're supporting the child labor, et cetera, because financially they can't afford the kind of stuff you can buy at Bloomingdale's and Neiman Marcus and places where they made, like in Italia or Peru or other places like that. That's my comment today, Gary.
Okay, it's a valid comment. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
We're out of time. We're going to continue this conversation tomorrow, so you'll have a chance to think between today and tomorrow. And I'm going to play the longest segment, again, of a third clip tomorrow. And also, I was given a new clip by Greg Lamastro I'm going to see if it's also going to be good, because I want to keep emphasizing how much responsibility we have for the world we live in and to climate change and to exploitation by what we buy. Have a nice day, everyone.